This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been thinking about the movie My Dinner with Andre. After the playwright Andre Gregory describes traveling around the world, pushing himself to extremes, burying himself alive, seeking the true meaning of life in theater, the playwright Wally Shawn makes a nice case for staying home.
Well, do you want to know my actual response to all this? I mean, do you want to hear my actual response?
Yes.
I mean, I'm just trying to survive, you know? I mean, I'm just trying to earn a living, just trying to pay my rent and my bills. I mean, I live my life. I enjoy staying home with Debbie. I'm reading Charlton Heston's autobiography, and that's that.
I was thinking about that scene because I was reading Charlton Heston's autobiography in preparation for today's interview. Of course, I also found myself thinking about Moses.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
Charlton Heston's voice reverberated in other biblical spectacles like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. He not only was close to God in his movies, he played the genius Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy. He was a cop in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lonely cowboy in Will Penny. He was the pursued in The Planet of the Apes and was subjected to earthquakes and airplane catastrophes in the disaster films of the 70s. But before we talk about that, there's the subject of Heston's new book, Beijing Diary. It covers his 1988 trip to China, where he directed a Chinese adaptation of the Kane Mutiny court-martial. None of the actors spoke English, and none of them knew who Heston was.
No Western film made since 1947, 48, has ever been shown in China commercially. You see them occasionally at embassies and things like that, but no, I was re-explored the interesting experience of anonymity while I was in China.
What happened to the People's Art Theater who you were directing with? What happened to them after Tiananmen Square?
They closed it. My cast caught up, as many, many Chinese were, especially artists, in the spirit of democracy that had been flowering carefully in the preceding year or so, demonstrated in Tiananmen Square on the second day of the demonstrations, wearing the cast jackets I'd given them all as presents, with the title of the play in Chinese characters on the back, Kane Mutiny Court Martial. And the largest of those characters was the Chinese character for mutiny, and that was not the kind of thing to wear on your back in Tiananmen Square. To the best of my knowledge, through limited information, none of my actors was imprisoned or injured physically. But they did pull the power at the theater into the... As far as I know, it's still closed.
Let's look at your career in movies and television. Back in 1950, you were signed by Hal Wallace, who was an independent producer. The studios were kind of in that transitional period of breaking up.
No, the studio system was still in place.
Mm-hmm.
Marlon Brando had gone into movies about a year before I did, and he had the first non-exclusive contract.
Yeah, so what did it mean to sign with an independent as opposed to a studio?
Well, the crucial thing was not independent or not. He was, in fact, an independent at Paramount using their facilities. But he was willing to give me what the studios would not do, which was a non-exclusive contract that gave me the right to do plays, to do television, to do films for other people.
Mm-hmm.
I owed Hal five movies, of which he, in fact, only made one himself, and he sold the rights to the others, which, of course, was entirely appropriate. I had no objection to that, but I was delighted to have the kind of freedom that now is routine. There's no such thing as exclusivity among actors and directors, but up to that time, the studio system was absolutely in control of all the creative talent.
What kinds of roles were you considered best suited for early in your career in the first part of the 1950s?
Well, obviously, large fellows with broken noses and bass voices. That's to begin with. Any actor is stuck with his own physical equipment. There are some actors, Olivier, who, aside from the fact that he's the best actor of the century, was also gifted with kind of a physical neutrality. He was neither very tall, nor certainly not short. I think he was barely under 6 feet. He had a voice of medium baritone range and a very handsome but regular face. And he could go anywhere. He could and did play Shylock and Lear and Hamlet and Antony. See, I could never play Romeo or Hamlet, just as Dustin Hoffman can't play Macbeth. So I sort of had to play captains and kings and emperors and cardinals and cowboys and cops in that line of country, which I've done both on stage and screen for most of my career.
You mentioned a broken nose. Did your nose actually get broken?
When I was playing football in high school, which I did unsuccessfully. But the nose was a great asset. I've gotten a lot of parts out of that nose.
I'm tempted to say...
Believe me, it's true.
I'm tempted to say they were able to cast you as Moses because with a broken nose you look more authentically Jewish.
No, more specific than that. In part because of the broken nose, I look remarkably like probably the greatest rendition of Moses in existence, the Michelangelo statue of Moses in the chapel of San Pietro in Vincoli in Rome. It's undoubtedly the most famous representation of Moses, and I do look quite a lot like it. Somebody pointed this out to DeMille while he was casting the picture, and apparently he couldn't get it out of his mind.
Charlton Heston is my guest. In the Ten Commandments, you had to lead and to speak to a cast of thousands. Can you describe what went into one of those scenes, or one of the really large scenes where all the extras were?
Well, the Exodus is, I suppose, one of the largest scenes of that kind ever filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took... To get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because you... To get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur or any of those films again because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you notice what a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But obviously those scenes are... In a sense, the English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. You are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even though it's all stage, you've still got, 8,000 people following
you. Yes, yes. It's quite an awesome experience.
Your infant son ended up playing the baby Moses in the bulrushes.
He began playing. He ended up a writer-director. I just finished working for him.
Oh, right, right.
So he began.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was the beginning and end of his acting career.
Right.
I think he realized the shortcomings of... a career in front of the camera and quickly switched behind.
Well, how did your baby end up getting the part? I mean, the striking resemblance kind of didn't
I don't think a resemblance was a factor.
Yeah.
My wife, who was then an actress herself, was unable to go to Egypt on the location because she was carrying our then unborn son. And DeMille was obviously aware of this, and he said, "When is the baby due?" And she said, "In February." And he said, "That means that he will be 3 months old, if it's a boy, when we get to the shots of the infant Moses in the bulrushes." And he said, "If it's a boy, he can play the part." And at about an hour and a half after Fraser was born, which was 3 o'clock in the morning, she got a telegram from DeMille in the hospital. It said, "Congratulations, he's got the part."
I thought you were going to say, congratulations, it's a Moses.
No.
So they wouldn't have used your baby if it was a girl, huh? I mean, no one could tell in the movie.
No, I don't think so.
Well, you couldn't really tell, though, could you?
Well, and I think Jews would have been offended.
You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is telling the Ten Commandments.
Which I think is perfectly logical. Because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Category for chariot races, though.
You're right. So you had to...
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture... I was a minimally competent charioteer, but as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, you know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here, and when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not. And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way real quick?
Mm-hmm. Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks work in the chariot, but he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There was all these scenes where...
action sequence... Mm-hmm. If the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And they didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident was I drove a great deal of the sequences, mm-hmm. but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out with and I didn't do that. Joe Kanat, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him because those things weighed 1/2 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, we got to use that shot. And Jack said, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot? And Willie said, well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in, which I did very quickly.
Did that look convincing to you when it was cut together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's totally convincing. It was not my favorite shot to do, I'll tell you, but it's totally convincing.
You had to climb back in as the chariot was moving.
Yes, but I was on the tongue of the chariot between the horses and the chariot itself.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me in the epic movies that you made, one of the things you had to do was show a lot of bare chest.
Depends. I'm in certainly The Slave Galley and Ben-Hur. In Commandments, in the brickyards, nothing in El Cid. I guess I was naked in Planet of the Apes for a couple of scenes. A certain amount of skin, no question. That's not unheard of these days either.
No.
What'd you say?
Absolutely. Have you been made some really ludicrous offers by people who wanted you to be at their event in some kind of quasi-biblical get-up or persona?
I think word has gotten around that's
that you don't do that. Yeah,
I wouldn't say that's a major problem.
Right,
it's come up once or twice maybe, but.
In 1969, you made the movie Planet of the Apes, which turned out to be a huge commercial success, one of the biggest movies of the year at the box office. What was your opinion of the script when you first looked at it and of the end of the final film?
I was impressed by the script. I was a little surprised at the extraordinary success of the film because it took 2 years to get anyone to finance it. See, this was, I suppose, Planet of the Apes was the first of the space operas in which we are still awash. You know, Star Trek and Star Wars and so on, Return of the Jedi are all space operas. And at the time, the studio said, you guys are crazy. You want to do a film with spaceships and talking monkeys? This is like Buck Rogers, Saturday morning serials. And that's how they viewed the genre, which had not been touched since the Saturday morning serials of the 30s. And, of course, we had struck a nerve with audiences, as filmmakers are still discovering.
I figure all the actors in the movie really envied you because you didn't have to wear the ape makeup.
Indeed they did.
On the other hand, you had to take a lot of physical abuse in the film.
I didn't get to wear any clothes in a couple of scenes either.
Well, you also had to take a lot of physical abuse.
It certainly was true. I didn't realize it until we were halfway through the picture, but in almost every scene I either get hit or chased or whipped or netted or sprayed with fire hoses, and it was a strenuous undertaking. But it's a good film, and I'm very glad I made it.
Yeah,
especially since, in effect, it started a whole genre.
Mm-hmm. Is it exhausting to go through a day where you take that much abuse?
Well, making a film is exhausting.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, making a film, acting in a film, especially directing a film, is not fun. It's not supposed to be fun. A movie's supposed to be marvelous to watch, exciting, amusing, frightening, whatever, inspiring, whatever it's supposed to be. But making it it's not supposed to be fun for the people who make it. On the other hand, as Orson Welles said memorably, making a movie is the best set of electric trains any little boy ever had to play with. And both those statements are true, and if you can't understand them, I can't explain it.
In the 70s, you starred in several of the disaster films, including Earthquake, which was one of the first. How did you end up being in, what was it, four?
We were all in disaster films. The reason for that is very clear. Disaster films are, in essence, multiple Jeopardy stories. You take a natural disaster or a man-made disaster or a threatening circumstance and put a cast of disparate characters, a dozen or 15 people who don't know each other, most of them. And the point of the story is how they respond to the circumstances. And it's a perfectly valid genre. But if you're making a movie about it, you have these 12 or 15 people, and you introduce each one in a scene in the beginning. They're usually not in the same scene because they don't know each other. They're not supposed to. That's part of the idea. Then you'd often don't see them again for half an hour. And if they come up again, you don't want the audience saying, let's see, who was that? Was that that fire chief in the beginning? And the guy said, then they want to say, no, that was Steve McQueen, dummy. This is Paul Newman. He plays the architect. And for that, you need very high profile, very well-known actors. And we all did at least two of them. And finally, they used up all the possible stories, and the audience got tired of them. And I think we were all tired of them, too, by then. But we made an awful lot of money out of them.
In Earthquake, you actually asked for your character to be killed at the end.
Well, I thought, you know, I said, I didn't ask. I had script approval.
Oh, you did?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
And I said, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. I play this nice architect who knows there's going to be an earthquake, and they got to build the buildings differently, and he has this terrible wife and this nice mistress. And at the end of the picture, the earthquake proves that he's right about the buildings, and it kills his mean wife, and he gets to go on into a happy future designing earthquake-proof buildings with this beautiful Canadian girl, Geneviève Bujold. And I said, let's surprise him a little. Let's have him killed, too. And so they did.
Did you have to work hard to convince them?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Charlton Heston is my guest. You served a very long term as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
7 years, yeah. Longer than anyone.
I'm wondering if you feel that that affected your acting career at all, and if you felt that
No.
I wonder also if you feel that, that Hollywood has ever divided politically, like the kind of director who might hire your liberal counterpart Ed Asner, or the kind of director who would hire you. Do you know what I mean? In other words, if Hollywood in its casting ever splits along political lines,
I
conservative
certainly hope
and liberal.
Not. I'm uh-huh. sure Ed hopes so too. Although Ed is implied sometimes that that is the case, I've never felt that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was president of the Guild, and up until that time, not only the officers, but most of the board members were very well-known actors. That is not true now, and I have no idea why that's true, except I suppose there are so many people in the Guild. There are now some 82,000 members of the Guild, which is a horrifying figure. But I've never, certainly never felt that my, not only my leadership of the Guild, but my political opinions in general have affected my employability. I still seem to be making a good living.
Did you ever see the movie My Dinner with Andre?
Yes. Yes, I know. I'm referred to favorably in that. And I guess that's the first time that's ever happened to me.
So when did you find out about it in the theater when you were watching the movie, or did you know by the time you saw the movie that your autobiography
was mentioned?
I can't
remember, frankly. I know two or three critics mentioned that, but I can't remember whether I read those comments before or after I'd seen the film. But I liked the film. I thought it was quite interesting.
And that must have been good for business, too.
Yeah, I don't know. I was not billed.
Okay. Your new book is Beijing Diary. It's based on the diary you kept while you're in Beijing in 1988 directing. You have an earlier book that's
also based on my journals.
Exactly. Yeah. Are you still keeping a journal?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
What kinds of things do you put in your journal? Do we just get to see part of it? I mean, do you have really personal things that you're not showing us?
It was begun as a work tool by 1957, 56, when I began keeping it. I had reached a point as an actor and director where I was having a lot of control over what I did and who I did it with and how it was done and all that stuff. And it occurred to me, since the working filmmaking community and playmaking community is actually a fairly small group, you tend to be working with the same people before many years have passed. If your career has any longevity, you find yourself working with the same cameramen, the same designers, the same actors, so forth, same directors. And I thought, if I write down what I think at the time, this will help me when I come to work with or consider working with these people again. So it began as simply that, a useful work tool. Since then, especially since I've now gotten two books out of it, I cast a wider net.
Charlton Heston, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for giving me such a long visit with your audience. I enjoyed it enormously. I do thank you.
Thank you. My guest has been Charlton Heston, and he's written a new book about directing the Caine Mutiny in China. It's called Beijing Diary.